Hello and welcome to the Stage Left podcast with Jim Sharrock, a fantastic guy, good friend of mine, amazing drummer. Seen him play some fantastic gigs in the last couple of years, following in the footsteps of Zach Starkey and his uncle Chris Sharrock as Lightning Seed drummer, playing to 30,000 people at Hyde Park last summer and playing at Glastonbury last weekend with She Drew the Gun. And it's a really, really great insight from kind of close quarters of the Liverpool scene. So Jim showed us about Parr Street Studios beforehand, and we got some great pictures on our Instagram page of things like Bill Ryder Jones's amp and the Corals guitars. I had a play on the piano that The Scientist was recorded on by Coldplay, as well as Clocks as well. That was a different piano downstairs in the main room. It was really, really fascinating, and Jim's got a real kind of encyclopedic knowledge of kind of Liverpool music, not only in the last kind of 10-15 years, but stretching back before that too. So you get a really, really good insight into Liverpool, into drumming, where things are going next as well, which is really interesting. So if you'd like to hear more from musicians like Jim and artists who've worked with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The Damned, The 1975, Bob Dylan, The Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast. And there's also additional episodes with the likes of Stuart Lee, the comedian, kind of deconstructing his creative processes and how they derive from listening to freestyle jazz artists, and loads more. So do check us out. Come and say hello to us online. We've been getting some really great interaction and in some really interesting discussions on our Facebook page. That's kind of where it's all at the moment. So come to our Facebook page, but do check into the Instagram and Twitter if you get a chance to too. Okay, enough of me. Over to the main man, Jim Sharrock. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Jim Sharrock. Thanks for joining us today, Jim. How's it going?
Hey, not bad on a very wet and miserable day in Liverpool, but I'm all better now for being on the podcast.
Cheers, man. So we are right now in Parr Street Studios, which is a bit of a legendary studio. Tell us about this studios and this kind of the relationship you have to this studios.
I'd say this is the hub of records that come out of Liverpool. You know, it's unrivaled, really, I'd say, in Liverpool. You know, there's a lot of other great studios, but everything I seem to do seems to be coming out of here at the minute, which is, you know, great, and all the staff are great. I know them all, and the beautiful people.
So tell us some of the stuff that you've recorded here.
I've done Sundowner stuff, She Drew the Gun stuff, a lot of live kind of footagey things they do in the main live room, you know, with like camera crews and things like that. And yeah, just it seems to be, I don't remember doing a session in Liverpool somewhere else in recent history.
Is this the most well-known studio for bands to come to in Liverpool, or is there other ones?
I'd say there was kind of like the 2007 time when, oh no, maybe a bit later, but Arctic Monkeys did their second album in a studio called the Motor Museum on Lark Lane, which was where Supersonic was originally recorded.
Right. Nice.
Which was called The Pink at the time, but now it's the Motor Museum. It was an old Motor Museum. And then that was always the place to go. I remember being in bands like 2009, and, you know, it was always Motor Museum. That was the place to go. And then it seems like it's shifted to Parr Street in a way. There's also Elevator, which is really good as well. I've done a few things in there, but it seems to be Parr Street at the minute. You know, the guys seem to know what they're doing here.
And Liverpool, tell us, why are people from Liverpool so good at making music? Why is this kind of concentrated area?
Oh, you're making my head go big there. I don't know, you know, I think it's the mix of like a small kind of vibrant hub. It's not too big, and I think that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, you're never like one person away from knowing someone. You know, you probably don't get that in other cities as much maybe, but I find like, if you want to track someone down, it's quite easy.
And the first kind of bands you were in, kind of pre-Sundowners, like, were they all local bands? Like, what was your first?
Yeah, definitely. My first ever band was called the Red Sons, and they were on Delta Sonic, which was really cool, getting to work with Alan Wills, who sadly passed away, and he discovered bands like the Zootons and the Coral, and was pretty much responsible for that explosion in the early 2000s of music.
How did you get involved with them? Were they school friends, or were they...
Yeah, Yeah, funny enough, a first band, my first ever band, it was kind of evolved, half of that evolved into this next band, which ended up being on Delta Sonic, and it was really cool because, you know, I was 15 at the time, and I'm so grateful for so many things. He managed to teach me, and he gave me I ended up paying for it in the end, but he did give me for a bit a beautiful 1966 Ludwig gold sparkle drum kit, which I'll never sell, and I've still got it at home. And you know, bar that, the recording things, everything, you know, he was great for bringing out and developing bands. That was probably what I'd say one of his strongest attributes were, along with his wingman Joe Fearon, who was very well respected around him, was kind of the other half of Delta Sonic, some people would say.
Cool. So why the drums?
Oh, is that a silly question? I just always, from being a baby, had a drum kit. Like, you know, just since I remember, I remember seeing a clip of me, and it's like a little kid's one. And then as I kind of got older and stuck with it and didn't get bored with it, I'd get one drum at a time off my uncle. I think I actually had his first ever bass drum for a bit. And, you know, get one drum at a time. And then I think it was about the age of 11 when I was like, I had a few mismatched drums, but, you know, I'd see drummers and be like, I want to have a drum kit like that. And I begged my dad to get a drum kit, and he got one off his friend's mum and dad. It was sitting in the attic. You know, I loved it like nothing I'd ever loved before. And I'd just sit at home playing it, taking it apart, setting it up different. You know what I mean? The things you do when you're 11 years old. And then I think it was about 11. I like really wanted lessons. You know, I'd kind of, you know, could play a bit, and knew what it was. And then at that point is when I started taking lessons.
From?
I'm going to have to ruin the legend that has been spread. It's not from Chris Sharrock, funnily enough, my uncle. Right. It was a guy called Red Carter. You can probably find him on YouTube somewhere, and he's a really old jazzer, and he did all ITV and TV shows, and he was, you know, like, he taught me to read, but he taught my uncle Chris. So when he taught my uncle Chris, he was about 40, and he had his own death certificate because he'd had a crash. They pronounced him dead, and he pulled through, and that was when he taught my uncle Chris. So I remember getting to the age of 11 and being like, I really want drum lessons, you know, I really want to go for it. And my nan, he was quite bossy with me, Chris, you know, with our Chris, you know, she will make him do things he doesn't want to do, made him find his number and ring him up. And when I had him, he was about, you know, 95, you
really?
Know, yeah, and he was amazing. Some of the things he taught, you know, they embedded in me. And I did have a couple of lessons here and there for the people, but, you know, there's nothing like that. And I've still got all the cassette tapes with our drum duos on them, which I'm going to have to dig out.
Yeah, cool, man.
Yeah.
Sharrock dynasty of drummers. I'm guessing you're pretty similar age to Jay, is that right? Who's Chris's son, who drums as well.
Yeah.
And did you grow up playing together as well, or what was, did you do much together, or?
You know, we'd talk, you know, we wouldn't necessarily, I think maybe once or twice at a family party, you know, that we'd both get on a drum kit, but it was, you know, it wasn't like, I used to go and watch him a lot, actually, because he's 31 and I'm 26, so I was at the age of about, you know, 13, 14, trying to get a sense on what's going on with music, and I'd go down to the Cavern, and he'd play in his first band, doing covers in there every Friday, and it was the first place I consumed alcohol at the age of 14 in the Cavern watching him, but...
What a know, place to do it.
Yeah, and you could smoke in there at the time. It was right before the smoking ban, I seem to remember, and I remember going again, and it never had the atmosphere. Well, sorry, it does have the atmosphere, but, you know, the smoking thing kind of... Yeah. Made it feel even more like the Beatles were playing, I suppose.
And how much of a kind of, if you take Chris Sharrock, I know he didn't obviously directly teach you the drums. This guy, what was the guy's name? Sounds like an absolute legend.
Red Carter.
Yeah, I think Chris told me about that guy when I saw him a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, he could hardly get up the stairs.
Yeah,
he was that old, but
he
was
really
amazing.
Rings a bell, yeah. So, as you know, in regards to Chris as a drummer, what technically do you think is most prominent in kind of yourself as a drummer, from what he's kind of given you any wisdom in the past, or?
He's very, I think, you know, his career's one that most drummers would, you know, love to have a small segment of, and he's managed to, you know, keep it going as a session drummer and, you know, find great bands to play in. And, you know, I think you make your own luck, don't you? And all you have to do is go and watch him and you'll kind of see why, you know. Someone said to me, oh, you don't notice him really even at a gig when he's throwing his sticks. It's not like the clangy drummer in the back. It's like the pocket groove, explosive Keith. It's everything really in one. He's not really one thing, I wouldn't say. Oh, Chris, he's got many strings to his bow.
Can you do the stick tossing
thing? I can
thing?
Throw it, but can't catching it is a different story.
That's to come.
Yeah, I have thrown a few with Louise and I've nearly hit her, and then I got a glare and just stopped doing that.
What would someone learn from working with Chris they wouldn't necessarily learn with working anyone else?
I've never worked with him, so it might be hard to answer, but, you know, everyone loves him. I've not really met anyone who's, not that he'd probably say it to his nephew, but not no one that's ever bad-mouthed him or, you know, said, oh, he's not the best at that. Everyone just goes, what a great guy, what a great drummer. And, you know, I think you can see that if you've met him, haven't you? You know, that comes across instantly. And, you know, he's a big, big role model, and I, you know, aspire to be half as good as him one day.
So one of the cool things that you do, and I came down and saw you and going to be coming again actually soon, it's absolutely amazing. If anyone's in Liverpool or wants a weekend in Liverpool, go down and see this. So Jim plays with a Beatles kind of tribute band. What are you called?
Well, they're called the Cavern Club Beatles. The
Cavern Club Beatles, and it's a Friday and Saturday night, and often Chris Sharrock is the main drummer in them, is that right? And
yeah.
Then when he's away with Noel, there's you step depths. In, there's yeah. depths, and, yeah. and you're one of them. Tell us about kind of getting involved in that and how.
I have not done a gig where I've laughed from sound check to tucking myself into bed at 2 in the morning before. It's the lads who I do it with, they're just like full of life, so funny. There's never, even when it is a dull moment, you're still laughing, you know, it's kind of. And then not to mention how good they are as musicians and, you know, impersonating the Beatles to some extent. So sometimes, when I'm playing with them and, you know, I might have had a beer and it's the last set and, you know, we're on Revolver Revolution, you know, you close your eyes and you're almost like, wow, I'm actually playing with the Beatles, like harmonies, playing wise, look, fantastic, the best Beatle band in the world by a long way, I'd say.
Tell us about how the two nights differ, because they're very different experiences. So just to kind of tell the listeners, I went initially to go on the just on the Friday night. The Saturday night I was seeing Father John Misty play the Olympia, I think it was. It was so good on the Friday night that Jim said, I'll just look to come down straight after you gig on the Saturday. And they were very different experiences. Like, yes. can you tell us how they differ?
Yeah, so they try and market the Friday as like mysteries and B-sides, but it's not that. It's like the rock and roll set. Maybe I've got that wrong, but it's like the rock and roll set, Roll Over Beethoven, you know, all that kind of thing, and then a few later ones, but, you know, it won't be kind of as visual or as dressed up as the Saturday. So whereas the Saturday is three kind of 45 minute sets which go through right the way, you know, there's four costume changes, do all the medleys, and trust me, they are the ones I dread playing because they're so hard. But you know,
what's the hard is it going into the second half of Abbey Road, right, going into
I really enjoy Slumbers and the solo in the end. I like that. It's the worst one is Good Morning Sergeant Pepper Day in the Life, because Good Morning, if you're a drummer, you'll know it's 10 and 9 and all this mad timing, and when it cuts, just you gotta really be switched on. It often I won't have a beer till after I've played that song,
really.
Yeah, because it's, you know, you just gotta like have to count it out loud still, because I find it, you know, it's not technically hard, it's just the timing and the feel is a bit tricky.
It's quite a pressured gig, isn't it? Because pretty much everyone there, I would say 70% of people there, are probably musicians who know the Beatles very well.
Yeah.
Who are in, I hate to say this, like, they're almost like looking for mistakes in a way.
Yeah,
like,
no, totally.
I remember standing there and just like kind of thinking, yeah, like, oh, that was exactly right on that bit of piano or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is a terrible position to be in, like, kind of on stage, I guess.
Well, that's kind of the big difference I found in doing covers and original, because I've done original stuff all my life and, you know, I jumped on the Beatle gig. So when you're doing your own thing, no one can go, that's not, bar the band, no one can go, you're doing that wrong, because you're like, well, it's my thing, so. But this, it's like, you know, it's tourists, different set of faces in every night, sold out every night, and you're just thinking, they've come from abroad to watch a Beatle band who are meant to be the premier Beatle band of the Cavern. They notice every time you make a mistake, but you've got to do the same thing as when you do it in original, just laugh it off and move on and kind of, you know, be confident that you know what you're doing.
Which night do you prefer? Because I'm going to tell you in a minute which night Chris said he preferred. Which is the night you prefer?
I like them both. I'd say maybe the Saturday.
Right, okay.
Sometimes when I do a Friday, I'm a bit like, oh, you know, I could do another set in.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, all the signs come out on a Saturday and you have all your costumes, and not that I like dressing up in costumes, but...
Because it's sat down, isn't it, the Saturday? So people sit down in the audience and...
Yeah, the first half of it's seating, oh, and then they're cool. Standing around. But yeah, it's got tables.
So in. The Friday night, it just seemed like it was just a proper gig. Like, it was just a gig, do you know what I mean? It was
like people, the cabin would have been.
Yeah, pretty much. People jumping up and down and stuff like that. Yeah, they're both great nights. If anyone gets a chance to go, it's an amazing way to experience the cabin.
Were saying to me in the cavern, you know, we were having a conversation. They were like, you know, do you reckon we've played in here the most? They've been doing it for a while, Tony, Jimmy and Paul. You know, do you reckon we've played in here the most in the cavern? And I was like, oh, I wonder how many times the Beatles played. And we got onto the subject of, they were telling, you know, the song When I'm 64. If something went wrong in their gig in the cavern, McCartney would go to the piano, which I believe, don't count on me for this, was in half in the crowd, an upright piano, and he'd just go and play When I'm 64 with everyone sat around him.
But really?
Like when they were really young, yeah.
How cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the first time you played the cavern, because I think that was one of your kind of, highlight, I'd imagine. So how old were you then?
I think I was 11, and it was my first ever band, and we had to go on at 7:30 because I wasn't allowed in after 8.
11 years old, you were playing gigs at the cabin?
Yeah, and funnily enough, where the Beatle band play in that room.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which is dead weird, and it was a lot different then. And I actually remember my Uncle Chris came, and there was a band on called The Grants. Correct me if I think they were called The Grants, and they had a fight on stage. Or like they had a big argument or something. But I remember walking backstage after my gig, and they were all just smoking weed in the dressing room, and it was the first time I'd gone, that doesn't smell like a normal... You know, you just kind of go, oh, that's what that is. But, God, them days are long gone of smoking in the cavern now.
And that... at 11 years old, did you really kind of get an appreciation? Did you know really how big a deal that was and how big the Beatles were at that stage?
I remember being into the Beatles, and I think I'd done maybe one show in the guitarist mum's back garden under a marquee, which, you know, was... I remember that was like the first ever time I'd played in front of someone. But the cavern was the first, like, proper, felt like what was a gig. And I've got it on VHS somewhere.
Have you?
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah, I'll have to find it.
Nice one. Awesome. So let's talk Sundowners. It's a cracking little band who got quite a cult following, haven't you? And it's like, your stuff is, so it's two female singers.
All the freaks love us, yeah.
All the freaks of life. Yeah. Why do the freaks love you?
I mean, you have to come and see it. No, I'm not sure. It just seems to be kind of freaky band. But I think we're such a close group of friends, all of us. You know, we grow up doing it. And I kind of, when I left the band, which was with Delta Sonic, that had kind of been and gone. And, you know, it's kind of like meeting your friends you've always meant to have met, almost, you know what I mean? It was like, oh, this is what a band's about. You know, maybe the other band wasn't going so well. And, you know, you dread going to play the drums a bit, which it should never be. If you find that the case, you know, that's when you should start. But doing the Sundown, it was like someone relit my flame. You know, I was only quite young at the time. I think I started when I was 17. And yeah, we just took it as far as we could take it, and we're going to take it some more next year.
Oh, nice. That's good to hear.
Well, there's plans to it anyway. Loose plans.
That's wicked. And in the band, so you've got James Skelly's brother, is that right? Was he one?
Brother and sister. So
brother
James and
sister,
Ian.
Right, okay,
yeah,
cool,
so there's
right.
James, singer from The Coral. Ian, drummer from The Coral, and then they've got a younger brother, Alfie, who techs for The Coral, and then their younger sister, Fiona. So there's four in total.
Ah, right,
they're all very musical, very switched on.
And was that stuff produced by James Skelly, is that right?
Yeah.
So is that the first kind of time he was getting into the production? Like, would that have been one of the first few projects?
Guinea pigs.
Really?
Total guinea pigs, yeah, and I think anyone had to say that. But, you know, we kind of... Skeleton Key, the label, wasn't really a thing at that point, and we were on like that wave of social media when you'd kind of put up a photo before a gig and not everyone would, like, you know, be on Twitter or whatever. You know, now it's like you haven't got Twitter, like, but yeah, it was great. And Skeleton Key kind of formed out of that. And, you know, James, once he saw what he could do with the Sundowners, started getting different acts. Like, I think Louisa from She Drew the Gun was, like, one of his second or third acts after us.
Really?
Yeah, because I remember on our first album tour, she supported us. On acoustic, I think, maybe. Or maybe electric, one or the other. But, yeah, it was just her.
And tell us about being produced by James. What are his strengths as a producer? And does he have any kind of... What's his approach to production? Does he have any interesting kind of angles?
Oh, yeah. So his latest one is, I want you to play like you don't know what you're doing. So basically, untrain yourself out of everything you know. So
wow.
He loves sticks. You have your drumsticks and you put your index fingers stretched out on them. And then when you strike either the hi-hat or the snare, you'll keep it dead. That's one he... Probably shouldn't be telling everyone this, but that's one he really likes at the minute. And he loves, you know, trying different... Oh, I'm speaking as a drummer, putting towels over the snare, under the rim, tightening it up. He's really, you know, he's quite
correct.
Going against the grain, yeah. You know, of what, like playing live is a totally different experience to recording with James.
What do you think he's trying to achieve by doing that?
I'm not sure. No, he knows what he's doing. You see him working with people and he'll sculpt them, he'll mold them, like the Sundowners, when we started, he'd be in the pracky room kind of as much as us for the first year or so. You know, he'd always be coming down, pushing us in different ways. I think he got the nickname Drill Sergeant Skelly for a bit, actually. Yeah. It'd be like, lock the door, because I think he's coming. But it was his rehearsal room, so we couldn't do that.
And one of your kind of highlights, you said, was playing Glastonbury with his Sundowners.
Oh, yeah, the first time. Well, they were both great, but the first time was really, really special. And, you know, what a great night that was. And we were on the BBC introducing stage.
Nice.
And, you know, it was kind of like that point where you can either, for what felt like you could flop as a band, or, you know, you can keep going. And we felt after it, you know, we did well and, you know, we got to keep going. And I think Alfie's and Fiona's uncle, Andrew, he does online stuff for like Sabian and kind of stuff like that. And I remember he was refreshing our Twitter page with us and he was like, wow, you're going up loads of followers at a time. You know, I think it was like 500, which, you know, seems nothing now, but it really was, like I said, on that wave of social media. And, you know, I remember they wanted to get me to wear glasses with camera on them for the show and it was all getting filmed.
Oh.
And Alfie, being the good guy, just went, no way, he's not doing that. But then, yeah, I think we had a big night after and we went up to Stone Circle and Alfie, the guitarist, I think asked the whole of Stone Circle, is Wilson Pickett dead? You know, and then broke his collarbone, as you do, on the way home.
Shit, really?
This was
after the gig, yeah?
Wow. We'd obviously gone full throttle after the gig.
Oh, he broke his collarbone.
Well, he was running around and I was like, Alf, and he had this big bag of beers, a crate of 24 beers in his backpack, you know, just running up to groups of hippies like, hey, does anyone know if Will Pickett's dead? And then I was chasing, I was like, stop running off, Alf. And he was like, I'm Neymar, because I think the World Cup was on.
Yeah.
And he's running down Stone Circle, if you've been, you'll know how steep it is, and two-footed, like, jumped in the air. And as he's kind of trying to somersault, the bag of beers pull him down on the hill.
Oh.
And then... because he was that drunk, I don't think he felt the effects. And then the next day, he couldn't lift his arm up. And it was like, okay, I think you need to kind of go the first aid. And they're like, yeah, your collarbone's broke. And that was the night the Rolling Stones played. And his first response was, can I have a disabled pass to go on the balcony?
And did he get it?
No, did he not? But he had to borrow Fiona's scarf as a sling because they didn't have any slings there. So we had this paisley kind of hippie. He didn't look amazing in the sling, you know, to be fair.
Which, talking about kind of hilarious injuries at Glastonbury, leads me quite nicely on to She Drew the Gun, because for those who listened to Louisa on a recent episode, I was hoping to see Louisa play And she drew the gunplay at Glastonbury a couple of years ago, and pretty much in the same spot slipped over and busted my ankle, meaning that I couldn't see the set, which means the only time I've seen She Drew the Gun was very recently, actually, when you played in London. Yeah. So how did you get involved with Larisa? And that, because that's a special gig. She's an amazing musician.
Oh, she's fantastic.
A fucking brilliant band.
Fantastic.
As well, yeah.
I think, you know, she can write a hit if anyone can. She's got it in her. Yeah. But it was last summer, and James had got in touch with me, he was producing her, and just said, oh, do you want to drum on the album? You know, it might be something in the future, kind of pretty loose. And then I was out with Ian during that summer, and then they had her album came out in October that I drummed on a second one, and The Coral went on tour in October, so I jumped on it for that tour and have been doing it since, done her album tour in February, which is the one you came to in the garage in London, which sold out every ticket. There wasn't a ticket spare for the whole tour. You know, she's fantastic. And I think at the minute, she's so current. People can really access what she's trying to say. It's and it's not like dressed up in any way. It's quite brutal, brutally honest, kind of her meaning. Which is, she's not that brutal in the van, which is quite good.
No, she's quite a different person, I'd say, from on the stage. Yeah. It's kind of a good thing, because I remember when I was going to interview her, I was kind of like a little bit intimidated about the prospect, having listened to her records. And you're like, oh, no, she's fine, she's really nice. And she is really, really lovely.
Yeah,
she's got a very strong message as soon as she stands on the stage, right?
Of course, and I think, you know, you don't get that far without having that. And, you know, BBC Six Music have really got behind her and championed, in particular, Steve Lamacq, championed both albums on the second one. And that's been a real, you know, push on to the next kind of thing. And Ignition, John at Ignition, who manages her, saw how well it was going around her album tour and just booked her winter tour straight away. You know, they're on it, and I think you're going to see her around for like a good couple of years to come. And all a lovely bunch of people as well.
Poem, you put drums on it.
Yeah. Well, I got told to play something different, and then halfway on, maybe at the first gig of the Coral tour, got corrected by Drill Sergeant Skelly, and he just said, do bass drum and make it a bit kind of dancey, like, not dance, bass drummer, you know, just do. And it works, you know, it kind of...
And you come in it towards the end, though, don't you, for long?
Yeah, she kind of gets to the first break when she says, don't quote me what she says, I don't know any words, but yeah, I know when it is, but, you know, and then it's just kind of like an extra gear live to use. It's a good trick, and, you know, no one's really expecting that because obviously the record is... not that. And the way she had it before we changed it to what it is now, it was kind of like marching snare, like, and it was good. I liked it. I didn't have a problem with it. Then the new way now, it's like, oh yeah, it makes loads more sense kind of why you do that, rather than, it kind of was coming in and it was a bit pointless. It didn't change it at all or add to it.
You supported Kasabian, is that right?
Tour with Sundowners.
Sundowners, yeah. Tell us about that.
So that was...
And Weller as well, I think, as well, did you?
Weller as well, yeah. Oh, we done two with each. Well, the Kasabian one I'll tell you about first. It was in Portsmouth. Pavilion Rooms. So, you know, it's a big, big place in Portsmouth.
Right.
And, you know, it was a big shot for us. We kind of... I think it was around the first Glastonbury time. Might have been just after that, you know, and it was... almost, dare I say, like the first reward from it or something. You know, you've ticked that box, so you're going to support a big band. And we you know, it's the first time we've been in like a huge kind of arena-ish venue. And it was amazing. It was like, wow, this is like dipping our toe in the big time. We love this. And I remember there was like a brief rumour they had another gig the next day for the War Child Foundation in London, but the support was sort... You know, it was kind of like, I remember in the weeks leading up to the Kasabian gig, there was a rumour going around, oh, they might ask you to do London. And, you know, Alf had been like, don't say anything to them, but, you know, they might ask, but they probably won't. They've probably got someone. So we do this big gig and we love it and we watch them and we're like, wow, this is, you know, this is where we want to go. And then we get in the van and we're like, oh, did anyone ask them to do London the next day? And like, no. And obviously Portsmouth to Liverpool is a good 6-hour, 7-hour drive. So we're all knackered, a bit drunk, driving home. And we stop near Bristol Way. And obviously everyone's fallen asleep in the van. And Alfie's like, shit, the manager's been calling me from SJM. They want us to go to London. They want us to come and do that. And this is about 4 a.m, because we obviously stayed and soaked up the atmosphere. So we're like, right, we've got to go. And so Alfie is calling his uncle Andrew, who I mentioned earlier, the digital guy, who does Kasabian, funnily enough, calling him. So that's Alfie's mum's brother. Alfie's calling him and going, you know, trying to get through. So I'm like, is there any way we can stay at yours? It's 4 a.m, we can't get a hotel. No answer, and he's ringing him, and we're like, oh, well, we can't just stay in the van, we'll have to not do the gig. And then Fiona, his younger sister, calls him first time, answers, oh, hiya, Fee, what's up? And he said jokingly after, I couldn't leave Fiona out in the rain, but I could you, Alfie. So we ended up going to his in Cambridge. We got there about 5 a.m, crashed, you know, wrecked his house, ate everything in there, and went and done it in London the next day. And it was, you know, a real special time. It felt like us against the world. You know, the stars align a bit, kind of. You know, I remember being not able to sit in my seat the whole way to Cambridge where we were staying because I was so excited to do it again and, you know, play like the first big venue we'd ever played. Or the second time, but, you know, yeah. 2 days. Which was a real kind of up there with Glastonbury memory for me. And the Weller ones were also very special. I think they were like kind of theatres in like the north of England, but like beautiful old, you know, red carpet, like nice. You can get that in any now. And he was a beautiful soul. He had his top off and was playing Alfie's guitar.
Really?
In the sound check. And he looked amazing. I was like, God, you look better than me and you're probably about 50 years old. But he was great. He's a lovely guy. I think he's quite close with James and Ian and stuff like that. And, you know, there's still a lot of love there and messages exchanged. So, yeah.
Okay, so you just mentioned Ian, and we had Ian on the podcast recently, and any Lightning Seeds fans, I think you'll really, really enjoy that.
It was fantastic.
Cheers, man. And one of the questions, I'm now quite, I see Riley once a week, we play in a pub quiz team, four of us, with the best, I think the best late name.
Tell him what the name is.
The Sugar-Coated Carlsberg, which I think is, yeah, I'm really happy with that, I came up with that on the spot. and I've asked Riley this question, and I've asked Ian this question, and they've been very kind of diplomatic about it. I'm sure you will be diplomatic too. Okay. But a question I really have is, you know, so you've got a father and son playing the band together. How does Ian and Riley compartmentalise being father and son to being bandmates from your perspective? And what could the rest of us learn about maintaining a harmonious relationship in a band from that?
I think they're first and foremost bestest of friends, and, you know, they will help each other through different scenarios, you know, and they'll give advice to each other. You know, Ian can't book a train ticket to save his life, like he'll book the wrong day. And, you know, Ian will give a lot to Riley musically, you know, not that he doesn't, you know, not that he needs it, but, you know, the yin and yang very much. And we did one gig in Edinburgh and Riley couldn't make it. I think he couldn't get out of something. He was in New York, I believe, and Ian was like a lost boy, you know, without his wingman, the bestest are best friends, and it's beautiful to see, and like lovely if I go and stay with them, and me and Riley, you know, it feels like we're all 18 almost, and, you know, various ages.
Amazing. And tell us about working with Ian. Really quite a genius. I mean, a great songwriter. He'll be remembered as such an important songwriter of his time. What are the highlights or kind of fondest memories working with him?
I enjoy it so much. You know, it's a real... I have a ball doing it, and I love them all. I love all the people who work around it, and he's great. He's, you know, he's great in rehearsal room. He's great in the studio. He's great live. You know, if you've been a bit worried, maybe he'll perk you up, or, you know, I try and give that back to him. If you know, you just got to have each other's back, and I feel like with him, he does, and, you know, really counts for a lot. And he's brought me on loads as a drummer, I'd say, and yeah, the songs speak for themselves, don't they? Yeah, they're not.
How has he brought you on as a drummer?
In loads of ways, and he, you know, he's shown me kind of like a bigger, like, you know, like the next kind, not when I want to say the next level, but, you know, he's taken me to that regular thing where you're doing big outdoor gigs quite often, you know, that doesn't seem to phase you as much now as where, I remember when I first did it, it was very like, oh, wow, you know, I'd never had people singing songs at me. And, you know, he really helped me to feel comfortable and big me up and make me feel good. And, you know, the songs are amazing to play. And I'm just proud to be part of it.
He said when he was on the podcast that drummers are the most important member of the band from a performance point of view. Do you agree with that, and why?
100%.
Why is that from your perspective? Do you?
I think you can give off a lot of emotion playing the drums, you know, and there's no chords, there's no majors, there's no minors, but it's weird hitting something. Well, you know, if you listen to like African music where it's all drums, it makes you feel something, doesn't it? It'll take you through a mood. And I think you've just, you know, I hear countless people say it, every good band has a good drummer behind them, and that doesn't mean, you know, they can do an outrageous drum roll. You know, Ringo is, in my eyes, is my favorite drummer, and, you know, he's unbelievable, but he's not like, you know, playing insane paradiddles and kick, you know, well, he probably is, but, you know, he's not meaning to, he's not thinking about it. It's all, it's very natural and hereditary drumming. And I think you can teach yourself to be good and do grades, but you have that like primal instinct. You've either born with it or you're not, kind of thing.
Someone who's played all of Ringo's stuff pretty much, I think quite, you know, people who know a fair bit about drums and fair bit about music get really, really frustrated when you hear the throwaway comments about Ringo not being a great drummer. It's so fucking annoying.
Nah.
What would be the things that you would cite? What's the one or two things that you'd reference to kind of disprove those people that Ringo wasn't a great drummer?
Song-wise.
Anything.
Listen to Rain. I just don't get it. I mean, you know, his style changes obviously through the eras, but how can you not get it? Like, just if you're struggling to understand what I'm saying, YouTube Beatles isolated drum tracks and you'll just get it instantly, you know.
What's
so pioneering as well? Well,
yeah, exactly. What would you say the most kind of pioneering parts that he had, or most complex parts to kind of recreate?
Well, I the ones I play, I've kind of studied a bit, and A Day in the Life is just mental. Like, and it, that, well, there's a lot, you know, it's, there's loads of them. I tell you what's a really good one to play, Getting Better off Sergeant Pepper. I love playing that. It's really fun. And the groove, you know, he just sits and he has this amazing feel all the time that is very hard to impersonate. I used to get mad at my school. The teachers that taught me weren't cool.
So feel, Ian talked a lot about feel when he was on the podcast. What does feel mean to you, and how do you cultivate it?
I think if you were diagnosing it, you'd be, say you've got your beat, you imagine you're seeing your beat and you're either slightly ahead or slightly forward, but per hi-hat and snare, you know, each thing can be, you know, your snare can be ahead, slight, you know, tiny, tiny bit ahead of the beat, but your hi-hat be sitting behind it and you can get something, or, you know, you can flip it around any way you want to do it. And you can hear a song when it's just like a lot of dance music's just programmed drums in it, and that's, you know, it's four to the floor and they don't shy away from that. But you listen to like Curtis Mayfield and that's like the ultimate feel. If you listen to Move On Up, the extended version with the musical outro, I think it's about 8 minutes long, it comes back in. That kind of will explain everything for you. Or it did to me anyway when I was listening.
Also said that his kind of point about being the important role of the drummer of a live performance, he said there's so many kind of different body parts involved, like two hands, two feet, that there's so many kind of variabilities that it makes every drummer naturally different.
Yeah.
What do you bring to the Lightning Seeds, do you think?
Oh, I can't say possibly. Good jokes and red wine. I'm not sure, really. I kind of... like doing, I've only like since the Sundowners kind of took a bit of a hiatus. It's the first, I've just really, like, you know, for the past 4 years, maybe been starting getting into it. And you kind of, you've got to suss who you're working out with and like put the right ideas to them, not necessarily the wrong ones, you know. So they kind of, yeah, you know, you just have to get on their vibe really of what they're after. But maybe if you can put your own thing in along the way, they will love that usually, you know, if they, you know, if you kind of take their idea, keep it the same, but maybe bump it up a little. But it's drummers. It's very fickle. Every drummer's different, you know. Every drummer is totally different, but I love it.
How do you approach being in different bands at the same time, locking in with a new bassist or a new band? Is that a challenge? Like, is there a great difference in the style between the different bassists in the bands that you play when you're playing simultaneously?
Luckily, they're all fantastic bass players, you know, bands and bass players. So it hasn't really... I've been lucky, touch wood, that I haven't... you know, I haven't had a real hardship of playing with someone when I found that. And, you know, I've had gigs when I can't maybe hear someone, but when you've been playing with them a while, you know, you just have to look at them and be like, just listen for me because I can't hear anything you're doing. But yeah, it's one of them. I've been lucky. I haven't had that bad bass player that just we don't get along at all.
What does Three Lions mean to you?
It means a whole lot more after last summer than it did to me. You know, it's obviously like the football song that you'd hear on the radio every 2 years. But, you know, when we did, like, we had the summer we had and the weather and the football tournament, like, it was like Brexit and all that wasn't a thing anymore. It was like the whole country was coming together and, you know, it was like, it was weird. It was like electric, you know, everyone was together. There wasn't any enemies, you know. It felt for like 6 weeks or whatever. It was really special, and to be like at the epicenter of that was, I was really lucky to be a part of. And I remember I got a text in the height of it off my uncle Chris, and we'd been playing and he'd been playing and they'd been singing It's Coming Home at an Noel Gallagher gig, which was, wow, yeah, I thought, yes, I'll take that.
So let's talk Hyde Park. So what a night that was. So you'd been playing some kind of smaller gigs throughout kind of the group stages of the England games. And then you sent me a WhatsApp saying, keep next Wednesday free, semi-final Croatia. We're about to announce it tomorrow, Hyde Park. And then all of a sudden, I saw you playing from like a few hundred people to like 35,000 people.
Yeah.
Like, fuck, that was such a step up in like that amount of time. I know you played some big gigs before, but that was a big step up in a short period of time.
Yeah.
Talk us through the week leading up to that and okay, rehearsals and everything.
Okay. So it was kind of like mid-summer. The band didn't have to rehearse because we were all, you know, we knew the score. We'd been playing it loads. And it had been mentioned. It was like, you know, the show in at Hyde Park, it might be a thing, it might not be. And my mum and dad have got a place in Wales and I've never been. They've had it for like 10 years and never been. And I was like, oh, right, I'm going to go. You know, I'm going to go down. It's in Pathelly, so it's about 2.5 to 2 hours from here. Get there, you know, it's beautiful, weather's hot. I'm like, oh, you know, this gig probably isn't going to happen. And I get to the beach, nail in the windbreaker, and the phone goes, can you get to London tomorrow? And I was like, oh. So it was like, right, pack up and go. And the person I was with was really upset to be leaving so quickly. So get back, you know, it's all happened really fast. It wasn't like, it wasn't too, although it wasn't, it all came about very quickly. And, train down, the hotels were through the roof. I'd told a few friends after it had been announced that it was happening, and they all were like, we've tried, everyone's applied to get a ticket, no one can get a ticket, can you get us in? And we had 100 guest list and I had 101 on it. You know, my friend Phil, who drum techs for Madness, will tell you about that story. So yeah, we get there and you know, it's just insane, isn't it? The stage, the screens, I think 100 metres across it.
Because it was already set up for, like, the British Summertime Show.
Yeah.
I think it was Paul Simon playing the week before or
Roger
week after
Waters and all that.
Okay, yeah,
yeah,
nice
yeah.
one.
Oh, you know, people with a lot better drummers than me.
Yeah, no. But there'd been opportunities, like, the stage was there midweek and it wasn't being used, so let's turn it into a big
thing. And I think, you know, the agent and the manager did dead well to make that happen. You know, what an experience to have. So I remember getting there early and you had to sound check about like, you know, 9 a.m. because there was a curfew or something. I remember being a horrendous sound check, like everything went wrong, you know, like I'm not going to say what, but, you know, sound-wise, sound problems, which is not really what you need when you're about to play to probably like the biggest crowd you're going to play to. So, and then we did the sound check, we got through it. And I think everyone was a bit, you know, God, like this is quite big. And then throughout the day, I slipped into, because we had, you know, we got treated like we were Roger Waters or Paul Simon.
Nice.
So we had like 4 Winnebagos where the sides pop out. Ab had her own one, who was playing sax with us at the time. You know, it was like, wow. And I kept thinking, God, all these people are here to see us. Like,
yeah.
Forgetting the England game was on after. But, you know, it was like, I had the best coffee I'd ever had, the best lunch, you know, the staff there couldn't have been, you know, they were just on it. You could, you know, it's huge, isn't it? You know, they know what they're doing. And so we're coming up to the gig time and it's kind of like, you know, just don't think about it. You've done this loads. You've done it all summer. You know what to do. It's fine. And the woman comes over. She's like, oh, can you just hang on? Because Sadiq Khan's going to be here in a minute. And we're like, you know, it's going out live on TV. You know, is he going to be here or not? So we're waiting around and we're like, you know what? We're just going to have to go on and do it. So we do it. I think we played about 4 or 5 songs. Obviously, we played Three Lions last. And then, you know, as we're coming off, kind of soaking it up one last time, it was amazing view, you know, a view I've never had. I've played, like, played a couple of arenas, and it's funny, the difference in that is it's pitch black and all the crowd are wrapped around you and go upwards, whereas this was like 30,000 spread out like butter on a piece of... You know, I've never seen that. It was crazy. So as I'm leaving, coming out through the curtain, walking back off my drum set, and this guy's like looking at me to shake my hand. You know, I just went up to him, shook his hand and walked off, because I just thought he was saying, oh, nice job, you know. Oh, you're just this monitor man. Sorry, not just the monitor man, but, you know, there's so many faces. And then I think Riley tapped me on the back, was like, do you know, you just blanked Sadiq Khan there. And I'm a fan of him, you know. I was like, ah, the one guy I wanted to meet. But he probably hates me now, because I just, you know, give him a bit of, oh, thanks, mate, you know, thank you.
Yeah, awesome.
But I think Ian had a really good chat with him, and, you know, he made up for my blunder.
And you and I sat next to each other watching the semi-final straight afterwards.
We did.
It was a bit of a heartbreaking night.
Yeah, it was. But I remember a lot of alcohol and elation being involved.
It
softened the blow.
I was going to say, it must be really hard, because you'd probably be on like the biggest high, perhaps professionally. I would imagine it would be natural if it was.
High at Hyde Park.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you just played like, and then England lost, and like I was really upset about it, and you just looked happy.
Yeah, it was weird.
And who could blame you?
Like, I think the depression and loneliness set in the next day.
The other kind of thing that you did kind of after that related to Three Lions was Sports Personality of the Year, where you played with Frank and David. That was a really interesting setup, because when I recorded the podcast with Ian, it was about a week beforehand, and he was saying, oh, there's like a lot of logistics around it. And then when you saw the performance, you know why, because it was lots of different styles of music kind of coming together. From your perspective, that must have been quite challenging, was it? Was there a click track you were playing to, or...?
Yeah, so sorry to spoil the magic, but the intro, so I don't know if you've seen it. So there's lots of British cultures, which you've kind of, you know, that was the whole idea behind the intro. You know, like I said before, it felt like everyone was coming together for kind of like the first time I've ever felt in England. I've never, you know, Liverpool winning the Champions League, that felt like the same thing. I don't know if you know about that. It was a couple of Saturdays ago. But, you know,
Jimson mentioned that literally every 5 minutes since I arrived this afternoon.
But, you know, so that was kind of like where I guess the musical director and Ian had got the idea from, to kind of make an intro and make it, you know, about England, really, and how well they did, although they didn't bring it home. They did a great job. Mm. So they pre-recorded all the intro, which I think was like a gospel, kind of an Indian section, a marching band. I forget the others. There's about four or five things. And, you know, I got so basically they pre-recorded that. And when you see that in the arena, they're kind of miming along to it, because you're not going to be able to record a gospel choir in an arena over a band. Well, you know, unless you...
be tricky.
Yeah, well, it'll sound a lot better doing it this way, but it'll look as good. Mm. So then the band were live. So we just had to... obviously, the intro was on a tape, and I'd get a click track in my ear.
And then Frank and David did a little piece, didn't they, at the beginning, sat on the sofa talking. Yeah, was that pre-recorded?
Well, yeah, they're not... they're just sitting there. But yeah. I don't think they were talking. I don't think... Yeah. You hear a guy go, Frank Mike.
Oh, okay.
But that's not... you're not going to hear that. Okay. You're just testing it. Oh, Frank's Mike. Or something like that. So then, you know, and then the MD who produced it all put like a 1, 2, 3, 4 in for where we should come in. But it was quite... the only daunting bit was like, you know, if you miss that, the whole thing's over. So whatever you do, coming in the right place. But it was good, you know. I'd practiced it at home, and I think I'd practiced it in my sleep for about 2 weeks. So it was, you know, it was nerve-wracking, but it was, you know, the buzz was great. And I always remember before I went on, my nan phoned me and just went, Chris and my dad's mum, keep your head up, will you? That's all I want you to do. Keep your head up and smile. So I had that going around in my head whilst I was doing it, but it was great. And, you know, it was cool seeing all like Tyson Fury and Harry Kane. Yeah, I'd rather see Tyson Fury than Harry Kane.
Here's a question. I mean, that's a really high-pressured environment, and a lot of us, no matter what we do, end up at some point in a really high-pressured environment. What do you do in that situation to not survive and just think, I'm going to get through this, and actually thrive in that high-pressured environment?
I'd say now it's slightly different to when I was you know, first getting myself involved in high pressure environments. But I don't know, you just gotta like weather the storm almost. You know what I'm saying? It's like you're on the floor and someone's kicking you, and you've just got to keep in the ball and be like, it's going to be okay. You know, I'm going to do this. Or, you know, you just got to take control of yourself and have that inner thing to be like, come on, you know what you're doing. You've done this in your sleep. You do it at home. You know, it's just strap on a pair and get the job done. Tough on yourself in a way, I think. But sometimes you can't help it. And, you know, you might have to go to the toilet for a nervous kind of moment. You'll come back out and do it.
And what were Frank and David like? Because I'm older than you, and Frank and David, when they did fantasy football, was just, a lot of people think my heroes were musicians, but genuinely, my mum, bless her, she was a single parent and she worked so many hours and stuff like that. And I remember she once, this makes it sound terrible, but it doesn't, it really doesn't come across like this, but she used to kind of tell me off the amount of for keeping them up on a Friday night because she had to work the next morning, because I was laughing so loud at fantasy football and it was keeping her up, like bless her, it wasn't in like a really strict way, but I really really loved it. So I went and saw Frank Skinner last week live in Leicester Square. Like, what was working with them like? Did you get a chance to interact much with them, or was it just kind of
I have to disappoint you, it was very very brief, I think, in the South, because we obviously did a dress rehearsal or two or three, like, you know, in the day before. And there wasn't much, you know, it was kind of like, hi, yeah, that was it. And, you know, I would have liked to have got to meet. I don't know if they were busy or nervous, but it wasn't that kind of friendly. But the highlight of sports personality was being a foot away from the World Cup.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's golder than you think it is in real life. You know, it is gold on telly, but you see it in real life and it's kind of got a shine around it. It's nice. Amazing, yeah. The woman didn't let me touch it, although I did try. one finger, and no, nothing.
What do you personally need to feel confident going on stage?
One beer, no more, no less. No, I think I only feel nervous when I don't know me stuff, kind of thing. That's the only time your real nerves settle in and you start going over it and you're going, what's the bit? But I think if you kind of learn it well enough that you know it, I've trying to train myself still to just go, well, just enjoy it because you know it. And then when you start freaking out, that's when you start making mistakes. So you just got to composure and kind of switch off. I don't know if it's the same for all instruments, but kind of you're thinking, but you're not thinking. You know, you're not kind of thinking what's coming up next, but you're not thinking about your tea. You're just kind of, you're like in a state of mind, really. It's kind of like running, like we were talking about earlier. You know, you switch off for a bit. You'll do gigs and you'll be like, wow, we're on the last song already of... Yeah, forgotten we've done all that, you know, kind of. Then other gigs where you're kind of not having it drag a bit and you're like, when's this over? Because I'm not doing myself any favours.
From a drumming perspective, specifically, does playing to a click in a studio take the feel out of playing live for you? Do you feel a slave to the click, or are you happy to play along to a click?
A lot of things I'm doing at the minute, I'm using a click live as well. And I really enjoy it. I don't have a problem. I like pushing off it and on it. It's great in that festival scenario where you don't get a sound check and, you know, half the time you can't hear anyone and they can't hear you. So if you know it well enough, they just play to the drummer and you know it'll be okay, which is a real good fail safe. But when you do have great sound and, you know, you've got the click, you can't hear it when you write on it, and that's kind of what they say. I have no problem. I see why people don't like it, but I personally thoroughly enjoy it.
What's the future for the drum kit, and what's your views on the electronic drum sets?
Everyone's going down that route. I mean, I'm a big, big vintage drum nut, as they say. But, yeah, it's going a lot more electronic. You know, there's triggers on drums, for anyone who doesn't know what that is. It's where you have a device that sits on the skin that is so sensitive, it'll register every hit you do to the dynamic that you play it at, but then you can put a sample in to trigger to that. So say when you went and watched someone and you're like, wow, that snare drum sounds like the chorus. It's because they've got a trigger and it's coming out. So the sound man can feed your real snare or your triggering, or your sample rather.
Really?
Yeah, so that's a big trick what people use. I see a lot of drummers using kind of butt kicker stools now, which I've never had a go of, which is basically a sub mic that goes in your stool, which feeds from your bass drum mic. So say you were sitting at home and you had a drum kit.
Yeah.
You'd feel like you were playing to 50,000 people. Huh. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. I mean, I've never used one, but I just love old stuff. Old stuff in new stands is my kind of bag.
Old stuff and new stands.
Yeah, because I've had a thing of going through drum stands last year.
What bad habits do you have technically as a musician that you would advise other musicians not to do?
Back and posture, sit right, as I'm slouching right now. Yeah. Back and posture, it's so important. And, well, I don't do this anymore, but I never used to wear plugs or in-ears. But now I just won't even bother because it's not worth it. You know, I think I've just saved me here, and maybe like mid-sundowners point I started wearing them because I just couldn't sleep for about 4 days.
After really?
Yeah, the tinnitus and the cymbals. I mean, just look after your ears. You're foolish if you don't.
What about tendonitis and stuff like that? Do you warm up before gig or?
No, but I shouldn't. I have had the odd thing. Yeah, I have had the odd thing through the years.
Oh,
where,
oh really?
Well, you know, just my forearm, like, and I'm lucky. I've just one thing I'm going to start doing again and get a practice pad in, like, maybe the dressing room. But you can do stretches and stuff, and I think you just got to look after yourself as well, haven't you? And make sure you get enough rest and drink enough water, because it is quite like, if you're playing in a hot club with no air, you're going to lose quite a lot of water. But it was funny actually playing my first gig. I got some good ear molds when I was younger, because I said to my dad, I was like, I can't sleep, and he was like, right, I'm gonna get you some good ones. Got some molded ones, and the difference, like, it was so weird getting used to coming off stage, not so much the playing, coming off, and your ears weren't ringing and you could think straight and you were relaxed.
Really?
It was, wow. It was weird. It was, anyone who's had it will probably know, like, the difference after the gig was, you know, you almost felt like you hadn't done one because you hadn't got this horrible thing going on in your head. But yeah, no more.
You've got to look after those tendons, man. Future self will thank you.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're the tools for your, you know, that's your toolkit for work. You know what I mean? Like, they're your tools for work.
Totally.
You know? So you've got to look after them, man. Recently, got to ask you, Louis Theroux.
Oh, yeah.
See, recently these guys played Zoe Ball's Radio 2 show, and you played a few Lightning Seeds tracks, and you did a Madonna cover as well.
We did, yeah.
Firstly, tell us about the Madonna cover, how that came about, and Louis Theroux was on the show at the same time.
Okay, well, the Madonna cover, Martin, bass player, had been wanting to do it. He loves that song. He's been wanting to do it for years and years. And, you know, it's never had the right time to maybe do it or whatever. Ian had a couple in the pot that he was kind of going in between. And we sent a couple to BBC Two or Zoe's producer, whoever it was, and they kind of knocked back everyone we said, bar Borderline. I think Martin was like, ask them if we can do Borderline. So I think that was the one they stuck with. And, you know, it's a cracking song. And it's good. I think the good thing is no one was really expecting that as well. It was, you know,
it's really left field.
Yeah, exactly. And that, I think all the other ones that are in the pot were kind of in that vein, you know, not like, don't know, what's a generic cover? Like, we, you know, it was trying to be something a little bit different that ever goes, wow, I didn't think they'd do something like that.
Mm.
But it, I think it came out a lot sadder than the recorded version, but good in a good way. Yeah.
Making such a fool out of me. Hold me in your arms and love me, well, I just can't see. But then you let me down, and when I look around, baby, you just can't be found. Try and understand, I've given all I can, but you got the best of me. Borderline. Yeah, I'm going to lose my mind.
And Louis Theroux, what's Louis Theroux like? That's the main reason most people will be tuning in for this podcast.
Yeah, I have had so many texts about Louis Theroux. He's taller than me, and I'm 6'2" or 6'3".
Oh, right.
And he was great, you know, when they played the music, when they play a song on the radio, everyone would talk for a bit, and it was quite nice getting to know him, and he was just like he is on the on his documentaries. And when you'd say something, he'd kind of do that thing where he puts like one finger on his chin and, like, you know, fixates on you like you're a stripper or something, you know, or something like on a show. It was quite intimidating, but he wasn't at all. And he was a great guy, taller than me, so I didn't feel like the skinny giant in the room for once. And yeah, he was bossy. He was a really nice guy. Saying about his kids, like, watching on YouTube people playing video games. He's like, they don't even like playing video games, they're just like watching people on YouTube.
Yeah, that's
just like the new thing. I've never heard of that. It's like, It's insane, isn't it?
Yeah, I really can't get my head around that at all. Regrets, we've all had a few. What are your biggest regrets in music?
My biggest regrets, not buying enough gear and instruments, which I've just started trying to do more. But
is that because, you know, the nicest possible way, you didn't have the resources to do that at the time, or was it laziness?
No, and, you know, knowing what you like and what you don't like. And I think, I've recently bought a guitar, and I didn't need it at all. You know, I can't really play it that well. But it was at a good price, and just thought I'd rather be that guy who bought it, regretted it and sold it, than the guy who went, oh, I nearly bought this guitar one time. But, you know, it's just like, why not? And your life's too short. It's only money. And, you know, if you need the money on a rainy day, you can flip it, can't you, and make it back. Or make more, fingers crossed, if you keep it long enough.
What have been kind of the near misses or, like, the biggest disappointments?
The Sundowners nearly all got arrested once.
Really?
It's not like a doing disappointment. Yeah, that nearly happened because I think someone had a joint, like, in the van, like, hours before, and the police pulled us over. And I remember getting out the police van, and Alfie spread his legs and put his hands on the bonnet, and the cop went, you're not in Miami now, son. But I just say, you know, open yourself up to anything, don't knock it till you tried it. Like, I've done a few gigs where, you know, maybe wouldn't be as interested as doing them again, but if you don't know, you know, you just got to open yourself up, try it. I've had a bit of advice on that, you know, be available and be the guy, and don't shut yourself off to any opportunity that might do you some good.
What's your most important piece of music memorabilia, or kind of something that you've got that you'd really like to, you know, if the house is burning down?
I should not be saying. Well, it's not so. Well, actually, oh God, I'm digging myself a hole here. I recently moved flat, and, you know, the Sundown was quite closely tied to the Coral, and we used their stuff. I was moving flat, and I was like, what's this drum skin here? And it had, you know, an old Wicker Man poster, because the Sundown didn't have a bass drum. Alfie had printed off an A4 sheet and stuck it over. As I peeled it off, it was a Coral Magic and Medicine bass drum head, which has been gig, you know, it's wrecked. And so I've taken that to the flat. None of them know. They probably will soon. And that's, I'd like my friend who I live with is a big Coral fan. He's like, yeah, we can put this on the wall. But he was going to come round the other day, Alfie, and I had to slip it under the bed so he didn't see it.
Awesome. Well, it's out now. It's out the bag.
Yeah, the secret's out the bag.
What do you want more from your life in music?
Everything.
Yeah.
Money. No. I had someone say, it might have been Noel, it's the journey, it's not the end destination, it's the journey, keep going. You know, if you're not enjoying something, anything, don't do it anymore, because you're not going to do yourself any favours. Unless it's revising for an exam that you need to pass or something like that, you know what I mean? If it's, you know, something to get you to the next level. But, you know, just go for it and open yourself up to every opportunity. Don't be shy. And, you know, if you're not the accomplished person you want to be, you might be one day if you keep going there.
What do you want less of in your life in relation to music?
Van rides. I'd like to get helicoptered into every gig.
Nice, isn't
That's not going to happen. No, I love everything. I'm so lucky to be able to, you know, play music, and I just want to keep going and enjoy every second of it. And, it's great, you know, the people you meet along the way. It's funny, like, I see a lot of school friends, you know, they live in London now, and I meet up with them, and they're great and I love them, but they're so kind of, I was thinking about it the other day, they're so different to my friends now, but the love's still the same. But, nice. You know, it's just the people who you meet, the tales you get told, and like you, Chris, the people you meet, you know, it's beautiful.
Fast forward 30 years from now, what would your future self be advising you to do differently right now?
Well, I don't know where I'll be in 30 years. What do you mean? Like, what if I'm 56?
Yeah. What do you think your future self would be advising you to do differently? You'd be like, why did you do that? What did you do? Or you should have done more. This should have done more.
I don't know. Maybe relax a bit more and stop being so uptight and control it. Or not control, but, you know, if something's out my grasp, I get a bit like, ooh, well, I should be, you know, if it's something to do with it reflects on me, I'm very much a take the bull by the horns kind of guy. You know, if it's kind of with anything, say my snare drum needs fixing, I like to think I'm the guy who will go to take it to the shop to get it fixed. Although some people probably beg to differ, but you know, that maybe like relax a bit and stop being so uptight all the time.
Why are you uptight?
Not sure if you see me air. That says a lot, which a lot of people say has died, and I just want to get this straight. It's 14, I've got a grey patch in my hair. Like Ringo, Malham streak.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, but now my hair's longer than it was at 14. I think it's more prominent, and it is going more grey as the years roll by.
It's got this kind of George Harrison feel about it. So I think it's a strong look, man. That's cool. You're looking the dude. What ambitions do you mainly have over the next, say, 5 years? What would be real things you'd love to tick off?
I want to do a lot more like traveling at like outside of music, because you know you get to go places playing music, but it's kind of like hotel, dressing room, van, gear. You know, it's not. You don't get. You might get to see one bar. And you will form an opinion of a place on one bar, which is a lot of musicians will do. They go, you know, Dundee's rubbish because that bar. And you'd be like, oh, well, I went to the other bar and I had a great night. I think, you know, it's. I would like to see the world a bit, maybe after November, do a bit of travelling. After, like, our busy November, do a bit of travelling. That's something I really want to do, kind of, like, have life experiences rather than materialistic things. And instruments. I'm going to have to try and stop buying instruments, which might stop me going travelling.
So a couple of kind of really exciting things you've got coming up in the near future. So you're playing Glastonbury with She Drew the Gun on John Peel stage.
Yeah.
And it's been televised, is that right?
I believe so. I think it's around 12 o'clock, I think. Don't quote me on that. But that'll be a really special one and made up for Louise. You know, she's earned that over anyone. You know, that she deserves that spot. She's done so well. And it'll be great to share it with her and, you know, have a great night after. Hopefully no broken collarbones this time.
And the kind of platform that she got to was kind of really helped by Michael Eavis, because she won the award, which was kind of new.
I think it was Emily, wasn't it?
Right, I think so.
I might be wrong.
She went to the final of a panel with like 3 or 4 artists, and then she got picked, and she was like kind of the new artist that would play that year. And that's about, I think it was 2014, something like that. So it's really nice to kind of reconnect with Glastonbury. And is Glastonbury like a fun experience from, you know, the playing point of view? I get what you're saying there. You go travelling, you don't really get to see the places you go to, etc. You see the inside of hotel rooms. Can you really kind of soak up the Glastonbury experience, do you think, when you play these places?
Well, yeah, Sundowners have always been a one night band, and we'll just go full health of leather one night, break your collarbone, back out. So that's kind of what I still do. Whereas I know Louisa and old She Drew the Gun lot wanted, they can't because they got a gig, but they wanted to go Wednesday to Monday, which kind of put the hairs on the back of my neck stand up when they said that. But yeah, I'm a one night guy. Pure, obviously, like, you know, go for it. But the next day when I wake up in a wet tent, you don't want to bump into me.
So One Night with Jim Sharrock could be the name of the other exciting thing you've got coming up later in the year, because you're playing the Palladium. I'd like to see that written at the front of the Palladium. One Night with Jim Sharrock. Yes, the London Palladium. I went there recently, only a couple of weeks ago. Actually, your uncle was playing that gig. It's an amazing venue. It's so legendary. Yeah. Bruce Forsyth's ashes are scattered underneath the
stage. I believe so. Is that where the Beatles said, stomp your feet or rattle your jewellery?
Correct, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was the venue as well. Great. So it's, a real, real kind of legendary UK venue. You must be excited about that, man. That's going to be...
Yeah, not like thinking about it too much at the minute, but it should be super special. You know, it's part of a good run of Jollification, which is a Lightning album, anniversary gigs. So it'll be, a real spectacle, we're hoping anyway. It's looking like it's going to be that kind of, you know, not just a typical gig. It's going to be a bit... something extra.
And you're playing in Liverpool as well, aren't you?
Playing Liverpool 2 days after my birthday, and it's the last one, so it'll be very special. You'll have to come, Chris, if you...
Yeah, man, I'm going to be both from there.
Philharmonic Hall, I've never played it. I've actually seen Ian and the Lightning Seeds playing there with the Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah.
And they got a few guests up that Ian had worked with, so like McCulloch, Miles, James.
Abby did something with them as well, I think.
Yeah. I think she did.
Yeah, she definitely did.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. That'd be real. I've always wanted to play in the Philharmonic's one to tick off the gig venue. And I think it'll be a really exciting November. There's a few things in the balance, but if that comes in, well, not if, that'll just contribute to a great November run. It should be great.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, I mean, thank you so much for your insight, Jim. You know, you're playing amazing gigs. You know, Three Lines is, you know, next year, Euros next year. Yeah, there could be something special. Yeah. You know, it's at Wembley.
I'll have to learn that drum roll properly for once.
You know, and your future's going to be huge. I mean, you're young. I mean, you're following the footsteps of Zach Starkey and your uncle Chris Sharrock and the Lightning Seeds. So, you know, you'll be playing with, like, The Who when they're all 120, I'd imagine, or something.
Still
like
be
that,
alive, I'll tell you that.
So you've got a great future. Best of luck with all of it, and thank you for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thanks a lot.
more episodes featuring Jennifer Batten on her time in Michael Jackson's band, Billy Burnett on 10 years with Fleetwood Mac, Tony Visconti on recording David Bowie's final album Black Star, and loads more. Go to thestageofpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at thestageofpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageofpodcast, and get involved in the discussion there. And you can find us on Instagram too. And yeah, come along, get involved in the discussion, share our page as much as you can, and let's get this kind of wisdom and knowledge out there to as many young musicians as we possibly can, because that's our mission statement, that's why we exist. And the next episode is with Jamie Moses on 12 Years in Queen. See you next time for that one.